Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
First of all, I'd like to say hi to Fazal. He doesn't know this, but my son has just started at Hereford in the blacksmithing course. Having spent 4 years at university, he now is doing a course he could have done when he was 16 or 17, which shows you the quality of good information, advice and guidance. Couldn't even get it from me. But then I didn't know much about this whole route, way and pathways into anything other than university. I wish that and the contents of that and that speed dating exercise could be put in every single classroom, in every single school, and in every staff room with every single teacher, so that teachers for the first time in their lives could find out what it's like to try and get a job. I think we'd all be in a substantially better position than we are currently. I actually gave evidence to the Alison Wolfe Review, and I made two members of the Teaching Development Agency who were in the same group with me very angry when I said that teachers know nothing about the world of work. The third one got very angry with them for getting angry with me, because part of the problem is that teachers don't know anything about the world of work. And I spent 20 years teaching, but I started when I was 30, so I had spent 10 years earning a living. And most of the finest teachers that I've ever met are those who have actually had stuff behind them. So that when a kid says, what's it like being a bricky? Or what's it like being a cab driver? Or what's it like, in my case, being a journalist? I can actually tell them, rather than say, here is a leaflet. Most of you probably know not going to uni. And in a sense, this isn't a not going to uni session. I'm here because of the things that I believe in. Not going to uni, when I spoke at a conference this time last year with the same programme, had 25,000 subscribers coming onto its website. We now have 125,000. And that's simply because we seem to be in a place where people want to come to find out information, advice and guidance about all the alternatives to university. I'm also co-founder of a group called Apprenticeships England, which is a group that's sprung up on LinkedIn over the last months, 1,300 people, who share the anxieties and concerns that we were trying to articulate this morning, quite unsuccessfully in the first session, slightly more successfully in the second session. I find the complacency around the information, advice and guidance as shown by Susan Pember disgraceful. And I'm not going to mince my words. I've heard it said, as I said in that session, from other senior people in DBIS, as senior as she is, that they are profoundly worried that the vocational and apprenticeship agenda will go by default, because there is now no obligation on schools to expose children to workplace learning, so it would appear, that what is defined as information, advice and guidance is whatever you want it to be. The act that went through Parliament was, and the Queen signed last week, in the section relating to careers guidance, is unamended. Alison Wolfe, as was pointed out this morning, mentioned careers guidance in her magnum opus on vocational learning, or what I call a dustbin job, mentions it once. How can you write a report for the Department for Education on vocational learning and pathways without mentioning guidance? When I challenged her in our session on this, her words to me were, please don't take me there. John Brown, in his report on student tuition fees, which has nothing to do with information, advice and guidance, I think mentioned it 18 times. So we have a challenge. If the schools are not going to deliver it, if at the best they're going to buy in some services from whoever offers them the lowest price, do we not have an obligation as training providers, as FE colleges? And I had this conversation yesterday with ASOC, the Association of Southeastern Colleges, and they didn't stand up and cheer, but they did agree. The burden must be on the FE colleges to take the IEG agenda into their secondary school, whether the schools want them or not. Because if the colleges don't, who is going to? We all know that in the FE sector, the average age of instructors, tutors, lecturers is apparently 75, I was told in a recent survey, substantially higher than it is in the secondary sector. Because in the secondary sector, get an NQT, 22 grand a year, it's cheap. Whereas older teachers, or people who come into teaching late with huge life experiences behind them, are too expensive. And I speak from personal experience. I came back into teaching at an advanced age after a 10-year gap. And I was head of one of the biggest sixth forms in the country. Trust me, I thought I was a good teacher. One or two of my kids might have disagreed. I couldn't get a job. Too old, too expensive. NQTs, cheap and cheerful. The FE sector is populated in, to a large extent, by people who have real experience of the world of work. So the challenge is, and I can just offer you the challenge, I think for the FE sector to proactively get out into the marketplace and be to deliver and offer to the, all of their local schools quality information, advice and guidance on the multiple pathways into the world of work, including apprenticeships, including foundation degrees. Kids who can't afford to study in London, you're a bright kid from Scunthorpe. You get two A's and a B. You really fancy going to the London School of Economics. 9,000 a year fees. It's probably more than the cost of a two up, two down in some parts of Scunthorpe. Please help, there's no one from Scunthorpe here. I've gone down this route before. I made a joke about comparing Speak to Albania. Speak is by Liverpool Airport, and there was somebody from Speak in the audience and he complained. I said, I've got nothing against Albania. What will it cost me to study in London? He'll take one look at the cost of accommodation in London, of a one-day travel card, of the cost of a cheap takeaway meal, and say, I just can't afford to study there. More children will be studying locally, as happens in Scotland still, as happens in many parts of Europe. And that is a huge opportunity for FE colleges to engage again with their secondary sector. Say, well, actually, your bright kids can come to us and they can study a foundation degree to give them a taster and then go on to a full degree and have the same opportunities at a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the debt that they might otherwise have incurred. And while they're with us, they can actually get exposure through workplace training to work placements into the real world of work. The second challenge is getting into the staff room in schools and to replace, if you like, their ignorance with knowledge about pathways. Because the teacher is the person who still has the most contact with pupils. He knows his pupils best. He might, in some cases, be a person of some influence, or at least he's a person of some authority, because he is the teacher. He is acting in loco parentis. And getting teachers far more aware. And part of this can be done by FE colleges running training courses as part of CPD for teachers in careers guidance. Possibly supporting teachers to become a level 4 accredited careers guidance person. Okay, I know the Act says that careers guidance cannot be delivered by employees of the school or people who are salaried to the school, which is unfortunate, but I still believe if a teacher at least has an understanding of what careers guidance is, an understanding of the world of work, by collaboration with FE colleges and local employers, he will have more credibility in the face of that young person when the kid says to him, well, what do you know about the world of work? You're just a bloody teacher, which I've heard on several occasions. Not to me, but I've heard it said. When I came back into teaching in what was the fifth worst school in the country in Salford, where 75% of the staff were supply teachers, where they were 95% poor white, 35% third generation unemployed. It was very difficult to command any authority with the kids because the parents had no exposure to the world of work. So I think there is an opportunity as part of the, if you like, corporate social responsibility for school, for FE colleges and independent training providers to start working in the schools. I've been talking to some training providers, for example, about taking over the ICT curriculum at Key Stage 4, which is one of the most diabolical pieces of curriculum planning I've ever seen, but as much relation to the world of IT as I do to, can't think of anybody. Anyway, it really is a nonsense. And they said, well, actually, this would be great, because then we can give them real industry-recognised accreditation in, for example, Microsoft Network Design or in Cisco Networking, which will lead seamlessly into an apprenticeship where they will get jobs. Do you know which subject at university has the highest level of graduate unemployment? I guess.
Media studies.
Everybody says media studies. It's computer studies, believe it or not. It's computer studies. And a room of careers guidance officers at a conference I spoke, not one of them knew that. But if you have done an accreditation for Microsoft, supported by training providers such as Zenos, you already got your plug.
Thank you.
That's the large scotch, please. Then you will have a much better job. One of the top guys from Microsoft does a presentation on recruitment into the IT industry. And all of the recruitment is coming from people who've done accreditations through the major networking software development companies. Do schools know that? No, they're teaching kids of 14 how to cut and paste in Word. My granddaughter, who is now in year 8, is being taught IT by the guy I worked under for 1 year in 2003. And she showed me the lesson plans that he's doing with them, and they're the same ones he was using in 2003. She's been on Facebook since before she was born. She uses Photoshop, she can build websites. She's just an ordinary kid, nothing to do with me. That's my daughter's child. It's irrelevant. So working with FE colleges, working with training providers, taking vocational curriculum into the secondary schools. Otherwise, going back to Susan, my anger at Susan Pember's complacency, what is there today in schools that gives you, responsible for post-16 education, any comfort that you will be getting candidates who have a clue what they should be doing or what they need to do a job interview or how to turn up on time? I mean, you're responsible post-16 for, in a sense, starting a vocational education and a guidance route, if you like, that should be starting in year 8, 9 and 10. So what are we going to do about it, please, somebody? Philip was here, but he's not here. Philip Turner is a director of York Consulting who did the survey on careers guidance that Debus published only a couple of weeks ago. And I exchanged emails, not with Philip, but with the researcher, because they quoted research that Debus carried out into satisfaction with the careers guidance service that was in place. And the satisfaction ratio was very high. They didn't quote the report done by the Sutton Trust that said that over 50% of children found careers guidance totally unsatisfactory, or the YouGov survey that said it was 75%, or another survey, which I can't remember, who said it was about 60%. The research that Debus commissioned used surveys that showed that everybody was very happy. Well, they are not very happy. They're not very happy. And the situation was bad yesterday. It is bad today. And the idea that online career guidance, such as not going to uni offers, can replace somebody who works with a child over a period of time, who knows them and understands them, and understands the demographics and the family background of the local community, can replace that is a nonsense. So, please, what are we going to do? What are some of you already perhaps doing about it?
We go into schools at the moment as a work-based learning team.
Right.
We focus.
Where is this?
This is Staffordshire, North Staffordshire.
Right.
We have a schools liaison team that goes into schools anyway. Yeah. But we found they were very much promoting the sixth form agenda in the college and standard vocational training, and work-based learning was always a poor relative.
Mm.
So we upset a few people really in the college by going in separately and talking about work-based learning.
But they let you in?
Yes, they bit our hands off. And we tried to focus on sort of years sort of 8, 9, and 10, so we're planting seeds early on.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, we haven't started this yet, but a lot of our employers, where we've got bigger companies, have identified sort of the lack of work readiness that people come out of school with, and they're keen to come into schools with us as well, because they've got that experience, they can talk about the job roles in engineering and all these sorts of things.
Now, is this because I know North Staff? Because before my son went to Hereford, he was University of Staffordshire in Stoke.
Mm-hmm.
Is this because of the particular economic structure of North Staff as compared with Surrey, for example, or Kent, where I am?
I wouldn't say so. I think the reason we started to do this is because we identified that at the end of the day, if you're going to be providing apprenticeships, you've got to get both the employer and you've got to match them with a suitable candidate.
Yeah.
So you've got to put effort into both employer engagement and candidate engagement.
Mm. When the door is open, it's easy. But as I know from direct experience in other areas, it can be extremely difficult. Is it Procter & Gamble, they're not a small company, have a major base, a logistics base up in the northeast of England, accounting, finance, all sorts of things. I remember their director of recruitment for apprenticeship said she was having difficulty even getting into schools. Now, we're not talking of we're talking Procter & Gamble. Because these were semi-independent, they were selective schools, they were grammar schools, they just didn't want to know.
And I represent construction employers, and I would absolutely back that up. And obviously, if Procter & Gamble are having a problem, you won't be surprised to learn that our members tell us that they have a lot of difficulty getting into schools.
And yet, I remember a school I was working at in another school in Salford during my Building Schools of the Future days, which was having problems with underperforming year 9 and 10 boys, and Rock Construction went in, introduced the BTEC course in construction, integrated it with maths, with numeracy and literacy, and the boys' performance in those areas went like that. But then, of course, they needed you. I bet you don't get many calls to Manchester Boys Grammar School for brickies.
You made the point that you think the challenge is for FE colleges to take on the roles of careers advice. We live in a mixed economy school environment where some schools have SIP forms and some schools don't. The schools that don't have SIP forms are very happy to work collaboratively with us. It might not be perfect, but it's pretty good. The schools that have SIP forms don't want to let us anywhere near their open evenings. The academies, who are even freer, So the local education authority schools, we all belong to the same sort of partnership group, and there's a tense but semi-collaborative relationship. We're still not allowed in to talk to sixth form.
I would argue.
And with academies, they won't let us in at all. They're not interested. They're their students, and we're to stay away.
Using the Education Act, which states clearly that schools have an obligation to provide impartial advice, including apprenticeships, and it specifies apprenticeships, I would claim that you have a legal right to demand entry.
That's not going to...
I know.
...any kind of relationship at all.
I know, that this is the frustration.
I think it would be a typical experience.
Yeah, and our relationships, in fact, I'm from an FE college, we've got a partnership with a sixth form college, we do a joint presentation to all our secondary schools, go in, we talk about apprenticeships, exactly the same as you. They don't have a sixth form, it's great. They do have a sixth form,
will the funding arrangements for sixth forms, because basically kids, and I've heard kids telling me about this at conferences, as long as the kid is in the sixth form until the Christmas of year one of the sixth form, the school's got the money for the year. After that, they can just go. And so many sixth formers suddenly seem to drop out in January, February, and they realise it's not for them. Now that, of course, they've got to keep them for the whole year, will the school say, well, actually, we just can't keep this person any longer, and this might concentrate their minds a little bit? I don't know.
But I went in as an employer to a tech college sort of yesterday, and she was, we don't want you, so they were sort of nervous of us offering apprenticeships to students that were in their first term of their course. And she said they're going out on work experience and employers are pinching our students.
There's an issue with, and it's a stupid issue, that if the departments were committed to doing something about it, they could sort out part of our FE funding, and increasingly for the schools, what comes from success rates.
Yeah.
If a student leaves partway through their course to go to an apprenticeship, that's a failure. It's not a failure because they've gone to a job with training. It's a failure. So that's why they don't want. That's why they're nervous
but
they're trying to balance.
But it's the same problem with school
leaving. But it could be sorted out.
It's a failure. This is partly. And this is where I do take issue with, as you can guess, I take issue with lots of people, with Simon Waugh. The brand has failed. the brand has never succeeded. If you were going in to sell degrees or sponsored degrees from Barclays Bank, they'd bite your hand off. Because everybody knows that a degree is a commodity that has clear and defined value, which everybody understands. Everybody who's got a degree knows exactly what they have to do to get it. Everybody who's got a GCSE in French knows exactly what they have to do to get it. How many people actually, even in this room, could actually say, an apprenticeship is this? Because it is so many things to so many people that it actually means almost nothing to anybody. And that's the tragedy of the debasing of the currency by things like The Apprentice. It doesn't happen in Germany. It's always the bloody Germans. If you do an apprenticeship at BMW, you will have started on that pathway at the age of 14. And no one will ever dare say to you, oh, you're doing an apprenticeship at BMW, I'm doing a degree at Heidelberg in philosophy. There's no inequality of status, because that's why 30% of Germany's GDP comes from engineering exports.
But it is about status of outcome, and that was the point I was rather badly trying to make at the end of the morning, but in terms of technician professions, they have technician status. So when they're actually qualified, they don't call themselves an apprenticeship or a success. They call themselves a technical title of whatever it might be.
Engineer Schmidt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is the end outcome. And one of the things that, there were lots of bad things about closed shops and demarcation disputes, but it did give individual trade sections a credibility and honour, so it was worth qualifying as X. And I think there is a disparity between, and I'm in a working for a group in the AAT that has a professional status and therefore apprenticeship may or may not be of value to it, but the end result is what matters to them. So they come out with an AAT or potentially a chartered qualification at the end of it. The problem is somewhat muddied elsewhere in that how do you get back the best of sort of trade self-respect and professionalism that has the sector as a whole caring about it and status within it without bringing back some of the other things that were less good about it? Because it's one of the other facts about the journey that often isn't mentioned, of course, is that a lot of the lower skilled jobs are done by immigrant labour who don't have any rights.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much a tiered employment society and it isn't all perfect, although there are a lot of bad apprenticeships. So it's quite a subtle argument, and I'm interested to see how some of the best examples of what the professions have retained can transfer across, which gives status.
Well, I've always used the argument that, you know, in the 50s and 60s, most people became...
five minutes.
Thank you. Most people came into accountancy, effectively, what was through an apprenticeship. You took articles with a local accountant. Many lawyers started that way. In fact, there are very, very, very few professions where you actually need a degree to practice. Medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, and architecture, I suspect, might be the only ones. But nothing else. You don't have to have a degree to be anything. And you might remember, when the University of Buckingham, which was the first independent university, was established, there was a whole huge hoo-ha because they were teaching their degrees over 2 years. In fact, what they did is they condensed 3 years of teaching and learning into 2 years. Nobody thinks twice about that, but everybody knew what is the content of a degree. And maybe if we could agree that an apprenticeship consists of a mixture of study and on-the-job experience over a period of a minimum of, let's say, for argument's sake, 2 years, that it involves certification across specific skills, numeracy and literacy, for example. I'm just throwing these out as ideas, so that when I pick up this piece of paper and say, this is the completed apprenticeship that I did, you know exactly what it represents. If I hold up my degree certificate, you'll know what it is. But as an apprentice, it's not. And therefore, even those of us who are theoretically experts upon apprenticeships, when suddenly confronted with, what's the difference between being an apprenticeship in accountancy and in building and construction? There are significant differences, and they're not... It's very, very difficult to communicate what should be something that is quite simple, particularly when, of course, they've never been discussed in the secondary sector.
So it seems to me that we're all facing the same challenges in getting into the schools, in mm-hmm. getting access, in finding, getting hold of vacancies, and mm-hmm. defining exactly what it is to be an apprentice.
Yeah.
But we do have a body that represents those issues, and it's called the National Apprenticeship Service. Has anyone had any assistance from NAS in terms of opening doors to schools?
I can answer that question. Because I was at a workshop 2.5 weeks ago with David Smales, who's the regional director of Southeastern London for NAS, and I asked him the question in a typical way. I said, when the phone rings at NAS and it's a school saying, can you please send us someone to talk about apprenticeships, is anyone there to answer it? And the answer is no. Their remit to work with schools has been defunded. NAS, he might have said this morning, NAS has end-to-end responsibility for apprenticeships, and I wrote the quote down, so I knew I'd use it later on. It doesn't. It is not end-to-end, it's middle-to-end. So NAS has no brief in schools, which is why Not Going to Uni does so many talks in schools, why we're starting to run online forums, and why my 1,300 members in the Apprenticeship England group are so... They all share... The anxieties that I'm articulating are, in a sense, the accumulation of the last 4 or 5 months of our members, tweeting about all sorts of issues along this whole agenda. But there is a consensus that says the message is not getting across to the right people. We shouldn't be talking to each other. We all know what the problem is. We probably know what the solution is. What we need are the Simon Wars and the Susan Pembers and the John Haynes and the Michael Goves and the Nick Gibbs of this world, and lock them in a room until they listen. It was very frustrating to spend 3 hours with Alison Wolfe. I know for a fact that the report was written before I even entered the room. And when she said, that 50% of vocational qualifications are worthless. I was very angry. They might be worthless to her. They might be worthless as a rate of exchange in calculating school performance tables, but that's not the qualifications fault that league tables make them obsessed with getting results. You tell a 15-year-old kid who's done nothing in his professional working school life or in play or in club that this is your certificate for having arrived in school on time with your shoelaces tied every day for the last year. What an improvement you've made over last year. And the whole class gives them a round of applause. And I've done that, and it makes a huge difference to that young person. Telling somebody that something they've worked for is worthless is a contemptible response. I get more angry about it every time I think about it, as you can tell. I've accused her of being a Hampstead elitist. She didn't respond. Well, she, I mean, you know, very clever family all round.
Sorry? You get into school by a parent power.
Or in her case, her daughter gets a job with Michael Gove. And half a million quid without any public accountability.
You need at least about 10 parents to battle against a head teacher or whatever.
I think there should be elected school boards.
We're on it on a PE front at the moment with my own children's school, but you know, that's, once we've tackled PE, we'll tackle a pension too. Yeah.
In fact, I'm thinking of setting up elected school boards for Hereford College of Technology so we can get subsidised bus fares to Holmes Lacey.
Yeah.
Joke.
Even harder to educate parents to get at them in many ways as well.
Well, you see, I got into trouble at my last teaching post because I actually wrote a letter to a bunch of parents who didn't turn up for a parents' evening. They were a troublesome bunch of kids, and of course the parents didn't turn up. And we had a few things we wanted to say, so I took it on myself to write very politely that I'm really sorry you weren't able to join us at the parents' meeting so we could share with you some of the concerns we have about some of the behaviour we're getting from some of our pupils. Two of them complained about my letter. So the deputy head hauls me into the office and she says to me, "This is not appropriate behaviour for a form tutor." I said, "Is this an official complaint?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Try. I'm waiting." The conversation stopped. But it's interesting. So you can't even challenge parents. I taught for many years in the French system. When French parents come to a meeting which is addressed by a teacher, they don't sit down until the teacher's entered the room. They wouldn't dream of sitting down in front of you at a parents' evening until you said, "Please sit down." And they all turn up. Sometimes with the grandmothers as well. It's different. Thank you very much for allowing me to rant a bit.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.